Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Now, about a year ago, I interviewed Matt Hewitt, who at the time was running Pro Snooker Blog and was just about to start work for the WPBSA as their media officer. So a year on, we caught up to see what he'd been up to, what's been going on, and what is ahead at the WPBSA. Well, Matt, last time we spoke, you'd literally just been announced as a WPBSA media officer. It wasn't quite clear then exactly what your duties were. So just tell us about the year that's gone by and how it's gone for you.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, it's gone so quickly. I can't believe it's over a year ago since I joined the dark side, so to speak. But no, it's obviously my title is WPBSA media officer, but I'm responsible for the website, and the other media that the WPBSA are putting out. I think the main thing to remember is that there is a key difference between the WPBSA and World Snooker, which I think even now is still lost a bit to the, even to some within the game, to be honest.
Yeah, because it always used to be that the WPBSA was the governing body and that was it. But obviously, as you say, now it has been separated. Just explain what the separation is.
Well, in respect of World Snooker, the body that perhaps most people recognise, they're obviously the commercial arm of the outfit, so their responsibility to put the tournaments on, sell the tickets, promote the players. That side, they're the side that the general public will perhaps associate. The WPBSA, on the other hand, is the sort of world governing body, not just for snooker, but for billiards as well. And we're responsible for, well, the players, the main tour players, but also sports development and the grassroots side of the game, from the ladies' game, the disability side, the amateur game in England. It all falls under our remit.
Yeah, they're all sort of constituent parts of the sport. They're sort of not the glamour parts, I guess, because the glamour parts are the professional game on television. But it's all part of the same story, isn't it? And with, you know, you need it all. So let's just go through some of them. The WPBSA, the B stands for billiards, of course. The forerunner of snooker, Rex Williams once told me there's no such thing as a snooker table, so they're all billiard tables. We won't argue that point right now. But billiards, of course, is never going to be as big as snooker, but it's important to keep the traditions going. And as I say, it's part of the WPBSA, that the B is for billiards.
Absolutely. We recently had this year's World Championships at the Novice Snooker Centre in Leeds, and it was a great success. For the first time ever, we ran a 100-up format in addition to the main timed format. Both were streamed, well, the latter stages of both were streamed via YouTube, which was very successful. We had your very own Clive Everton came over to do the commentary, and it was very well received. The traffic was very good, and it's something that we'd hope to do again in the future. It's going to continue. Obviously, the new season will kick off. And you know, it's something that, over the last few years, perhaps it's slightly out of the public eye, but the billiards tour has developed into a sustainable, strong tour which receives great entries in terms of players. And as I say, perhaps surprisingly to snooker fans, it's really doing very well at the moment.
I suppose you have to be realistic, don't you? And you know, it's never going to be like snooker, 19 tournaments on TV a year. You have to find the sort of right level. And as you say, the streaming, I think, was significant because that several thousand people watched that. And it may be something that people would stumble across on YouTube and maybe possibly sort of quite like.
Yeah, even myself, it's no secret that I'm not from a billiards background. I'm a snooker fan first and foremost, but it was interesting for me to watch the streaming, and particularly who better to do it, the commentary than Clive, and to explain the game, the principles of the game, and the nuances that, once you understand them, you realise just how skilled those players are.
Let's talk about the women's game. That recently had the women's Masters that Rhiann Evans won. Again, you know, it's about being realistic. The women's game, because there isn't the strength in numbers, is not going to rival the men's game in terms of popularity, but everyone's doing their best to try and promote it as much as they can.
Yeah, and I think it's come a long way over the last couple of years with the support of the WPBSA. From December 2015, it was announced that the WPBSA were going to play a stronger role and provide greater assistance to the World Ladies Tour. Part of that is myself. I've been to all of the events over the last 12 months. It's been interesting for me to meet the key personalities, see the players in action, and to hopefully put the sport on the map.
And the World Championship, the Women's World Championship, is going to Singapore in March, which is a sort of different direction.
Yes, it'll be a different direction for me.
As you're going there.
Absolutely. Yes, as you were previously, well, perhaps go on to this, but perhaps the before I'd taken this job, I've never left the UK, whereas now I've been globetrotting a bit, but not to the extent of Singapore. So that'll be very interesting. Yeah, as far as the sport is concerned, it's a new location. We're going to have a very glamorous pre-reception party at the Marina Bay Sands Hotel.
Very nice.
It's very spectacular, so that should be very good. And then, yes, the tournament lasts for a week. Rhianne Evans, Michelle, will be there to see if she can make it title number 12.
Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for Rhianne in a way. I mean, obviously she's not sorry that she's winning all these world titles, but it's where she goes from there. She has tried to... I mean, it's not a men's tour, the professional tour. It's a professional tour. Women have played on it before. In fact, Rhianne's played on it before. But you almost feel like, apart from just keep on winning, she can't actually do any more in the women's game. And unfortunately, you know, the money isn't great, is it, at the moment? I mean, it's going up a bit, but it's not sort of necessarily a great living. So it's hard to see where she goes. She's almost in limbo. She's like queen of her sport, maybe not quite at the level required, though, to be a professional.
It's a difficult one. There's no easy answer. Mm. The only thing we can do is to continue to grow the game, and you know, by the time that we are, the prize money is up to a stronger level, then she will still be around to benefit from that. She, as you say, she set every record. She's won more world titles than anybody else, more UK titles than anybody else. She's been number one for a long time. She will be back at Ponds Falls this year to have another crack. Obviously, she pushed Ken Doherty close two years ago, 10-8. It'll be interesting to see what she can do again.
I guess the important thing for all these things, the women's game as well, is participation at the grassroots and encouraging. Because, I mean, traditionally in Britain, snooker clubs go back maybe 30 years. They're not the sort of places you would have taken your daughter. A lot of them not the sort of places you'd have taken your son, frankly. And it's getting that sort of fixed idea people have, oh no, yeah, I wouldn't let my daughter go to a snooker club, and actually maybe explain to them that times have changed.
Yeah, it's really encouraging, because we did have, at the last event, the Masters last weekend in Derby, we had 8 entries into the under-21 competition, which is a good improvement on what we've had recently. Mm. Obviously, we want that number to keep growing, but there are young girls, young women, who are interested in the game and who are encouraged by the events that we are putting on. All we can do through our new initiatives, which we'll come on to later, I'm sure, is to help to provide the environment and the facilities to allow women, disabled players, and all amateurs to enjoy the game of snooker.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the disability snooker, which I know has been a big thing for Jason Ferguson, the chairman. Just explain what's been happening with that. There's been quite a few events already.
Yeah, the WDBS, World Disability Billiards and Snooker, set up in the summer of 2015. Since then, there's been events in Gloucester, Manchester, Woking, Hull, my home city. Yeah. Get that one in.
City of culture.
Absolutely, yeah. And they've all gone very well. In particular, Gloucester, from 2015 to 2016, the entries have doubled. We've had pieces on the BBC on the main coverage during the coverage of the UK Championship recently. But those events have been so much fun to attend. I've been to them all so far. And there's just a special atmosphere about those events, the people involved. There's some great people involved. Some great players involved. We spoke about the billiards earlier, Raja Subramanian. Mm. He's a player who has won our Gloucester event in his category for 2 years in a row, but he also competed in the World Billiards Championship. One of the things that has really come out of the disability side is that we've seen players not only become players but become role models. Mm. They've started to venture into the world of coaching. We've had a couple of guys, Steve Packer and Mark Parsons, in the Q Zone here at the Masters this week. We've had players becoming referees, players helping at other events in different categories. So there's a real community growing there.
Just explain how it works, though, because obviously disability is quite a broad term and people have different disabilities. So I guess there's lots of different categories, are there?
Yeah, there's a very big classification system. It's approximately 40 classification profiles. But we break these down into 8 groups, which loosely termed are physical disabilities, learning disabilities and sensory disabilities. So far we've had events for physical disabilities. Then we've had events for sensory disabilities separately, but we're looking into mixing and matching a bit more and just seeing what works at the moment.
Because it's important, because when Jason came on the podcast, he spoke a lot about the Olympics, but of course there's also the Paralympics, and sports governing bodies have to be seen to be making an effort for disabled athletes as well. So it all ties into the, I guess, the same sort of end goal in a way.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, I didn't realise this before I became involved, but the snooker was a founding sport of the Paralympics, yeah. And it remained there until 1988. Yeah. So we've got pedigree there, and it's, you know, what we will be back one day. It's just going to take time to. Obviously, we have the events that have been successful, but we just need a bit more support, perhaps commercially, to take it to the next level, which we're currently working on.
Sure. Well, another important part of grassroots is coaching. What can you tell us about the there's been a new coaching programme launched.
Yeah, so obviously for the last few years we've had the coaching programmes that we've got. Head of coaching, Chris Lovell's played a great part in that. But to bring us into line with other sports, we're now moving to an accredited coaching scheme with the assistance of First for Sport. The aim of this is that it's not just a case of potential coaches completing a course, then qualifying, but going forward, further announcement will come in due course, but it's more about having external bodies involved, and it's more about a structured process that will bring us into line with other sports, and it will just provide a more structured coaching setup in this country and beyond in the world.
It seems to me with a lot of these things, there's a lot of work being done behind the scenes that people kind of don't see. Obviously, you're involved in that. Maybe you can tell us a bit about Jason and his work ethic, which seems very strong. I mean, he always seems to be travelling somewhere, meeting somebody, trying to do the groundwork for a lot of these things. A lot of it comes from, I guess, personal introductions and meeting people, taking the time to sit down and then formulate all the plans, which he seems to enjoy doing.
Absolutely, yeah. His air miles must be spectacular. he's in one country from one day to the next. The work he puts in is absolutely incredible. You only see a snapshot of that otherwise on the tour, but he's flying to China, to Switzerland, to Rome, he's been everywhere, and I couldn't speak highly enough of the work that he puts in, not just because he's my boss. But obviously he's very good at that. He's very, he loves sport more than anyone I know, even more than myself, dare I say it, which is very unusual.
Yeah.
But he's played an incredible role in the development of the sport, and we have targets as to where we want the sport to be, and if anyone can do it, he can do it.
One thing that obviously helps is funding for grassroots, and there's been a new... Tell us about this new English partnership that's been launched.
The English Partnership for Snooker and Billiards is an umbrella organisation which was formed earlier last year, and it brings together the key stakeholders from the bodies that we've spoken about already, so the ladies' game, the disability side, the billiards side, the English amateur side, and it's all about just making sure that their voices are heard and effectively working towards the goal of increased participation, improved facilities in this country. Obviously, at the moment, we have a main tour full of players, and a number of English players are on there, but in 20 years' time, we need to make sure that there are more players on there.
One of the problems, seems to me, is that a lot of the funding... I mean, British sport is well-funded, but it's targeted at Olympic sports, because the end goal seems to be medals, and that's worked. You know, we looked at Rio, obviously London 2012. Snooker's not in the Olympics, so... Does it suffer, do you think, because of that? And also because of various people's prejudice, a lot of people don't see it as a sport.
Yeah, Jason would be the first to tell you that we are at a distinct disadvantage compared to other sports. We don't get the funding that they do. And it's about time we got our fair share. As part of this process, we have recently prepared proposals to Sport England. We've submitted a bid for funding for projects such as for the over 55s, for women players, for disability players, and we're optimistic that this will be the first step towards getting our fair share of the pot.
It seems like a long process, though. I mean, like I say, you have to lay all the groundwork and do all the work. I mean, how hopeful are you that this funding will actually come through?
Well, we've put the groundwork in over the last two or three years. Now we've formed the English partnership. It's still, obviously, we're still working on it and putting the procedures in place. Part of that is the national governing body status. That's historically has been part of the English Amateur Association. We're currently in the process of hopefully transferring this to the EPSB itself, which will again allow us to represent all of the interested stakeholders in the sport in this country. We were aware of the challenges that exist and that are there in front of us, but regardless of the response that we received from Sport England to this particular bid, we're optimistic that we've put the procedures in place, that the right people are now involved, and that we will get there.
Okay. Well, in terms of the Olympics, we've got the World Games coming up in Poland, and it's called sort of the Olympics for sports, not in the Olympics. There's all sorts of things in there. I always remember dragon boat racing I saw once listed, and korfball and all these sort of things, but Q Sports are in there. I guess that's an they've been in there for some time, actually. I think Nigel Bond won a gold, Gerald Green won a gold, and they sort of got their little time on the podium. I remember Nigel saying they stood up and they played the national anthem. But I guess it's a sort of showcase, isn't it, to show people that actually, you know, these are really popular sports.
Yeah, it's a crucial. it's crucial that as a sport we are involved in these multi-sport games. The first time snooker was involved was in 2001. Not just snooker, but also pool and billiards, carom billiards. And it's an absolutely vital showcase. It's our time to shine, and it will be really interesting to see what we can do. I'll hopefully be going to the event, and it will be interesting to see how we are received. But it will be fantastic to see us take our stage, place on the stage, and it's a key part of hopefully one day making it to the Olympics and back to the Paralympics.
That first one in 2001, Laurie Annandale, who's one of the best referees for a long time, he went out there to officiate, and because a couple of the snooker players had withdrawn, he ended up playing in it. I mean, Laurie was part of the Stephen Hendry in sort of Scottish amateur event, so he was a good player in his day, but he wasn't expecting to end up competing. But I think it's become a little bit more sort of professional since then, and like you say, it's important to just showcase the sport. And this, I guess, comes down to a lot of people. I mean, Ronnie O'Sullivan said it, would say that snooker doesn't need to be in the Olympics. You know, we've got the World Championship, that is the pinnacle, nothing's going to beat it. I guess the counter-argument to that is, though, if you're in the Olympics, it is a worldwide showcase for the sport and could only attract more interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a difficult... Obviously, it's not a snooker where we have this debate. Golf, tennis, people will say, debate whether they should be in the Olympics, but certainly, if they're in the Olympics, there's no reason why snooker shouldn't be. It's not about picking other sports, but the participation levels that we have, the viewing figures that we have, there's no reason why we should not be in there. Mm. It's just a case of putting the basis there, so that we can make a structured bid. We recently submitted a bid for the upcoming 2020 Games. We came very close, but hopefully with what we're doing now with the grassroots sport development initiatives that we have, hopefully we'll go one better in the future.
Yeah, it's a great shame, I think, that all this wasn't done years ago, because obviously host countries can, they seem to duck their own sports into the Olympics. I think they get two choices, don't they? And, you know, we look at Beijing, where China's such a big snooker country, and then obviously London, you know, British sport and all that. Unfortunately, those chances were missed, but hopefully in the future things will change. Let's talk a bit about you, Matt, because as you say, when you took this job, you'd never been abroad. Now you're sort of basically snooker's Michael Palin. You're travelling everywhere. I mean, the first one you went to was Gdynia. So what was that like as an experience?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, actually. It was quite a strange experience, because being from Hull myself, which is quite a port town, Gdynia was actually very similar, so it was a bit of a home from home, to be honest. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And since then, I've been to a brief stop in Dublin, and then obviously the Poland's Classic last year in Germany in Fürth, which was a lot hotter than Gdynia, I can tell you that. But yeah, it's been an amazing experience. It's hard to think a couple of years ago, I would never have imagined that I would have done half the things I would have done now, but it's only the beginning as well.
Yeah, because, I mean, you obviously started coming to snooker as a spectator. You actually paid your own money, unbelievably, to buy tickets. Then you sort of came into the media room as a blogger. now you're coming to tournaments as an official. Quite a meteoric rise, really.
Yeah, I do have to. I do have to pinch myself sometimes. It's very bizarre.
Chairman this time next year, the way it's going.
Don't tell Jason that. No, it's very. It's ridiculous, really, to be honest. To think of it when I think of coming to the Crucible for the first time in 2005, stood outside at stage door waiting for Ken Doherty, who was one of my heroes growing up, looking to get his autograph, and then. This week sat around a table having meetings with him. It's a very, as I say, I do have to pinch myself, but I like to think that enthusiasm breeds interest and is infectious, really. And without wanting to blow my own trumpet, I think I work hard and...
Blow it. No one else will. Blow your own trumpet.
That's true, yeah. So, yeah, I like to think I've worked hard and, you know, hopefully this is just the beginning. I'm just at the start of a long journey here with the WPBSO.
But do you have to be careful? I mean, you're never one on Twitter to sort of mouth off about things, but you're now being employed by WPBSO. Do you have to sort of be a bit careful in terms of giving opinions and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think that's natural. Mm. I mean, everyone has been brilliant with me. Nobody said, don't say this, don't say that. It's not really been like that, but just it's almost self-filtering. Yeah. Myself, I'm aware, as you say, beforehand I was never the most controversial of bloggers, and obviously that's not going to change now. No. But I've not found that to be a problem. I think the thing that is really interesting about this role is that most people would assume that the main tour, obviously being the main tour, is the most challenging part, perhaps because of the what is at stake for the players, but. In many ways, I've been doing that for 10 years already, so that is the easiest part. The real interesting challenge is the sport development projects that we're doing, and I've learned so much over the last year, and it's only going to get better in the future.
Do you miss the old blog, though, doing the old blog? I mean, I know you do it in a different way now, but do you miss, the independence that you had?
Not as much as I thought I would have done, perhaps, because I think the snooker landscape has changed. Mm. 5 or 6 years ago, there were a lot more politics in the sport.
that's one way of putting it.
Yes. Understatement of the year. Well, 7 or 8 years ago, perhaps, probably more accurate. But I feel I was very lucky, and it was not something that was planned, but I set up my blog at the same time as you, a couple of years after yourself, but at one of the most interesting periods in the sport's history. The growth that we have seen, the changes that we have seen, we've moved from 6 or 7 events a year to several events. We've had a ranking list change to a rolling ranking list, money list, flat 1-8 draws. The changes that we've had have been groundbreaking to the sport. And to be blogging as an independent blogger during that time was fantastic. But perhaps now the call for that isn't there. Mm. I feel the blogging landscape has changed a little bit, perhaps. It seems to have settled down the tour. Obviously, things are still going to change this year. We've got the Home Nations, which has returned, which has been a great success. Perhaps the most radical changes that have been brought in have been and gone now.
But also, I mean, I think back to when I used to do my blog. You know, you would have like 3 weeks between tournaments to sort of think of things to say. There's not time now, really. One tournament finishes, that's it. You move on to the next one. There's no time to sort of reflect on anything. And I'm not sure there's the hours in the day, really, to sort of maintain a blog to the level that we used to.
I remember, for example, at the qualifiers back in Pontins, you would have the Bahrain Championship qualifiers, and I would write not just daily updates, but session updates. I had so much time on my hands, I would write 3 updates, like every match, every score. And now, you can't even get a tournament preview in. It's challenging, but it's all positive, in a good way.
Yeah. The rankings, of course, is something you keep on top of, and there's a lot of races that we need to know about. The main one, I guess, for most people will be the Crucible, because it obviously is such a massive difference being in the top 16 and not being in the top 16. But there are others as well. Tour survival is a big one. I wanted to mention Ken Doherty, who's been a pro since 89-90. He's in trouble.
Definitely, yeah. And I don't like, as I said earlier on, he was one of my heroes growing up, so... I don't say that lightly, but just to explain how the tour survival works, perhaps it's not the most it's not the most publicised system. But the top 64 all stay on the main tour for a further year on a 1-year card. this year, it's changed up a little bit. Previously, 8 tour cards were allocated on the basis of the European Order of Merit. This year, with the European Tour no longer in existence, those places will go to the top 8 players on a one-year ranking list, not already within the 64. So getting that out of the way, it's the two key methods by which players can stay on tour. And at the moment, Ken Doherty is outside of where he needs to be on both lists, so it's not sensationalist. He's very much at risk. That's not to say that can't change, however.
This is not your area, but there are these wildcard. Steve Davis had one, James Watanar. I think Ken would be a pretty outstanding candidate for one. I know you can't sort of say the way, but that could be an option as well.
Yeah, no reason why not. As you say, it's not my department, but as a world champion, you would have a strong claim, I would imagine.
Yeah. The race to the World Grand Prix, I mean, that's sort of complicated by Germany that's coming up, because literally Germany finishes on the Sunday and that starts on the Monday, so there could be someone who wins the German Masters that gets into that.
Yeah, it's going to be a tight turnaround for somebody there, perhaps, but it's the final event. Just to explain, the World Grand Prix qualifying list is based upon a one-year system, so all points earned from the start of this season in Riga up to the conclusion of the German Masters, all prize money rather, will count towards qualification with the top 32 making it. It's interesting because the field at the moment as it stands is looking very strong. Of the top 20, only one of those players, Martin Gould, is currently set to miss out, although he is the defending champion in Germany and will be looking to break back into that bracket. What's also interesting is that we've got a few of the players such as Yu Delu, Yang Bingtao, Zhu Yulong, so the young Chinese talent that are beginning to emerge, who, okay, on the main ranking list they're still a bit further down, but on the one-year list they're right up there.
We've also got the Shootout, which is now a ranking event, and regardless of the rights or wrongs of that, which has been debated on this podcast and elsewhere, it's a chance for someone there possibly to get to the Crucible. I mean, 32,000 to the winner, you know, that could be a big leap. If you're sort of 2021 in the world, a Dave Gilbert, someone like that, that could get you to Sheffield.
Yeah, definitely. Look at Robin Hull last year. Had it been a ranking event then he would have been boosted significantly up the rankings. It's a real chance for somebody. I think I'm right in saying that nobody inside the top 16 has won the Shootout yet. Yeah. So it could be a real opportunity for someone to make a mark, regardless of the rights and wrongs.
Let's just go back to your role then at the WPBSA, because, I briefly was worked for them many years ago. I don't talk about it much. But whenever I went to meetings then, they were always dominated by politics. So the thing that you were supposed to be discussing, you weren't, because something had happened and something in the paper, whatever. That's gone now. So how do these sort of meetings go? Are they sort of long affairs? How sort of democratic are they?
I would say they are long affairs in so much as we've got a lot going on at the moment. But in terms of politics, I've not experienced anything of that side. On the board we have Jason Ferguson, who we've spoken about already in his little introduction. Nigel Moore is the vice chairman. He plays a huge role in respect to the disability side, the governance side. And then we have Jan Verhaas, obviously, who is recently appointed.
It's been a year of unexpected election victories, and that was one of them. I mean, Jan, the great guy, Jan, but I think a few years ago he wouldn't be an outstanding sort of candidate as a politician. He wouldn't necessarily put himself forward, but he has done, and he's going to look after the sort of refereeing aspects.
I'm sure he'll be a bit more popular than some of the victors we've seen recently. But he's got a huge role to play, and working with him, we can publicise how people can become referees. We couldn't do it without them. And
as Rob Walker always says.
And it's not just in the UK, and obviously he's not from the UK, so we can... there's a huge part to play in attracting new referees to the sport. We've seen a number of them over the last few years at European Tour events. Many of those now are still continuing to be involved. And it's going to be exciting to see what he can bring to the party.
Players Forum is another sort of side part of this. And you hear sometimes, some players anyway, will tell you that, oh, it's no point going to that, no one will listen. But it is there for them, isn't it? I mean, that's the idea, that's their sort of forum to go and air grievances.
Yeah, definitely. I think, changes maybe afoot on that front in terms of how the forum works going forward, which will probably be, decided over the next few weeks by the time this podcast is made available. But, in principle, the Players Forum exists for the players to meet, to put their views together and to communicate these to the board. then Jason's job, he's not only chairman of the WPBSA, but he's on the World Snooker Board as well. He's there to represent the WPBSA and ultimately to represent our players. Mm. So if the players do get together and communicate through the right channels, then there's no reason that their views won't be heard. In terms of the right channels, you know, we see a lot on Twitter at the moment, and it's great to see the players' personalities on Twitter and social media in general, but it's also important that certain things perhaps are communicated the right way.
I guess, though, to defend the players for a minute, a lot of them would say, OK, we can go to the players' forum, we can put all our points to Jason, but the sport is run by Barry Hearn, and what Barry says goes. I mean, this shootout thing, he's one of the very few people I've met who actually thinks it's a good idea. So they might say, well, yeah, we can go through all these channels, but if Barry says it's going to be like this, it's like this.
I guess that's the... it's a fair point, but there are changes that have come about as a result of the Players' Forum. For example, some of the draw structures we've seen this season at 1-8 events have moved more towards a tennis system. Mm. So where you've had, I think, the German Masters, the European Masters, you've had the top 32 seeded, everyone else sort of in at random. Mm. It's perhaps not been publicised widely, but that was as a result of a suggestion by the Players' Forum. So it's not a case that the Players' Forum are ignored. Barry does listen to them, and there is evidence that they can make a difference.
And what is the general sort of relationship like between World Snooker and the WPBSA? Because I think Barry's attitude is, it's not that he doesn't care about all the things we talked about, but he's very much focused on the commercial aspects of professional snooker, and he's happy to leave all of this to Jason. But how do the two sides sort of work together?
Very well. I mean, from my perspective, we have, I work with Ivan, who is the press officer for World Snooker. He's obviously sort of my contemporary there. He's been there a lot longer than I have.
He's been there forever.
Yeah, it seems like it. He hasn't aged.
No.
But, you know, we work very well together. We liaise together. Whenever there's a ranking question, World Snooker will come to me. Whenever I need one of our projects given a bit of a leg up, I will go to Ivan. So there's great synergy there. And in terms of the boardroom, Jason represents our interests very strongly, very robustly. And from everything I've seen, both bodies appear to work very well together.
Okay, so a year on then from making the move, you're glad you did it?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very different life, but I say it's very different. It's kind of not, but it's...
It's the other side, though, you're on, I guess. Yeah. You're looking at it from the other point of view. Actually, you're now inside the governing body.
Yeah.
You see how it all works.
Exactly. It's the... I don't know if it's unique, but it's, as you described earlier, I've been fan, spectator, watching on TV, to going to venues, to blogging, to... I've seen it from all sides, so I like to think I bring that to the party, that I've... When I can think of the spectator's point of view, I can think of the player's point of view, I've got a good relationship with many of the players. Mm. And it's been an incredible journey, but as I say, it's only just the beginning, and it's exciting to think where we're going to be 1 year, 5 years from now.
Okay, Matt, well, thank you. And we'll talk again in a year when you're chairman.
Don't tell Jason that.
Cheers.
Thank you.